You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Page to Stage,
a conversation with theater makers.
We're your hosts.
That's Brian.
That's Mary.
To put it simply, we're both theater nerds.
So let's pull back the curtain and get a glimpse at the artist's process while creating their art.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hi, my name is Rob Rokicki. I'm the composer lyricist for the Broadway musical, The Lightning Thief, the Percy Jackson musical.
Which we just had the privilege of seeing last weekend.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I.
So much fun. It was. The energy was great. The kid behind us, I feel like it was his first Broadway show, honestly, which is amazing because he was like, hey, mom, what about this? He would like ask her a question or he would.
Hopefully I'm not spoiling anything, but at one point something throws into the audience and he ran to the front of the orchestra to go grab that.
And bring it back to his seat.
I'm sure his mother was thrilled with that.
And then we had like five ladies on like a ladies' night in front of us, and they were like bopping their heads the whole time.
Oh, I love that. That's the cool thing about the show is you get this demographic that's like all over the place. You get these like kids that have never seen a show before, and they get like fall in love with theater, and you get like a whole different group of people from all ages.
I feel like especially since this is a book and a movie, and so there's definitely a following outside of that. So you're definitely bringing in new people who haven't experienced theater before.
So I work at a library, and I saw one of the kids had a t-shirt on from the show. And I said, oh, have you seen it? He goes, I've seen it like three times. I saw it on tour in Philly. I saw it somewhere else, and I saw it off Broadway. And I was like, oh, cool. I said, I'm interviewing the composer this week. Do you have anything to tell him or any questions? And he said, no, just tell him I said hi. So Willie from Totowa, New Jersey says hi.
Hey, Willie from New Jersey. Thanks for coming out. I appreciate it.
So I want to kind of take it back a little bit.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
Absolutely.
So what was, if you can remember, what was the earliest experience of theater that you have?
I did a show when I was in first grade. It was my neighbor. At the time, a wonderful actor who's randomly his mom, he's since passed, but his mom is a big theater lover. And she came to see the show the other night from Colorado, from way back in the day. I hadn't talked to her in like 30 years. It was longer. It was crazy. Anyway, her son had done a show, and I was like, well, I want to do a show then. And that was first grade. It was a show called Going Buggy. It was about bugs are like trying to sue the government for equal rights. I think I played the bad lawyer that worked for the government, but don't worry. I have a change of heart at the end. The bugs win. So that was, I think that was where I literally, got the bug, but like, I was not planning that.
Wow.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Early, really early. My mom sings in a choir. My dad is he was a doctor for many years, but he was a pianist, a classical pianist. So I grew up like loving old musicals. My grandmother was a singer. Both my grandmothers were singers. So I have a love for musicals and operas and a lot of classical stuff too.
And did you learn to play piano when you were younger?
Yeah, I learned again, like I was kind of not like forced to only listen to classical music, but that's all that was around. So yeah, I loved growing up listening and learning how to play piano to like Bach and Rachmaninoff and Beethoven. And then I discovered show tunes and it kind of went downhill. I discovered like Bon Jovi and like chess at the same time. Whoa. And it was a big eye opener for me. That chess soundtrack was rock music and rock music in ABBA? Theater.
Was there an instrument that you wish you learned or that you haven't learned?
Well, in high school, I learned guitar. I think that was kind of the advent of like alt rock in the 90s. So I was learning like, you know, Radiohead. I wanted to learn every guitar song, and I learned guitar like so at camp at Interlochen where I went for an arts camp. I wanted to like, you know, I was that guy writing songs on the guitar. There's a couple. I really wish I could learn drums. I'm not a great drummer. I've tried. For a show, I had to learn accordion. That was a lot of work. I play a lot of random things. Today I was recording and I played ukulele, melodica, glockenspiel, piano, acoustic guitar, some electric. Yeah, it was fun.
Always wish I learned to play an instrument.
It's fun.
It's never too late, though.
It's never too late. It's tricky, but, you know, also I love writing on different instruments for different characters and things like that. Sometimes you get different ideas for a song if I'm writing on a different instrument.
Would you argue that maybe like a different instrument has a different voice for each character?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that's how I wrote Lightning Thief, you know, for sure.
Having that makes so much
those
sense.
Ideas in mind,
because
you think like Percy, he's this young angsty teenager that is thrown in all these kind of volatile situations. He explodes with like electric guitar. So I used a lot of electric guitar to write. And then like Annabeth, she's super analytical, super smart. And so I used a lot of very notey kind of keyboard sounds, Rhodes sounds, stuff like that. Sounds like kind of a computer. And like Grover, he's a bit of a hippie. So I used like acoustic guitar and like melodicas and like kids instruments, panpipes, stuff like that. They were just like, let's have a more like laid back fun vibe.
Yeah, I love that.
So if we go back to when you first started working on the Lightning Thief,
sure.
When was that and how did that fall into your lap? Because originally it was a TheaterWorks tour.
Right, the fabulous organization, TheaterWorks USA, that has been around for a long time. They've had a really good reputation of being able to adapt these, beloved books for theaters for young audiences. And they also support a lot of initiatives getting people who have never seen theater before from underserved areas to things like free summer theater. So they had kind of quite the coup getting the rights for this book, because Lightning Thief, you know, it's the best-selling children YA fantasy series, American fantasy series, I think in the last 15 years of all time, number one, like for that many years. So it's, you know, the fans
and a huge been, franchise, a huge, and a huge franchise, series.
Huge series. They'd never taken on something this big before. You know, it's like a nearly 400 page book to make a 1 hour version of that. It's really ambitious. Also, the movies were not well accepted by the fans nor by the creator, Rick Riordan, because they didn't quite get the tone or the nuance or a lot of the plot and things like that. So we had a real uphill battle. We had to kind of win over Rick and his agents and make sure they were on board. And then we also had to appease the fans as well. And then we also had to appease theatergoers who don't know anything about this. Imagine someone who's never heard of Harry Potter and then explaining to them, all right, I'm going to take all seven books, but kind of like ideas of that, but really just focus on the first book and then like write a 1 hour version of that. That's kind of the Herculean task we had ahead of us to make this thing. So Joe Trace had found it first, our book writer. He saw on his agent at the Times desk a copy of Lightning Thief, and he was like, oh my gosh, I don't know who I have to talk to get that thing made, but I want that. So they were like, oh, well, TheaterWorks is working on that. And so he adapted it as a book, for as a play, I should say. And it was pretty soon in the process, Barbara Pasternak, the artistic director at TheaterWorks, was like, we got to make this thing sing. We got to compress more time. This is, you know, angsty rock music would feel really right with this. Who do we know that writes that and who could adapt it? And I think they reached out to a mutual friend of mine, Joe Iconis, that suggested me for the job. A couple other writers submitted demos. I was lucky enough that my song seemed to be the right fit, you know?
Yeah. So when you're
tone-wise, yeah.
When you're asked to submit some songs.
Yeah.
What is that process like for you? How many do you have to submit, and what kind of a time frame do you have?
It's different for every project, and usually you have no time and you have to create, like, you know, in like a day, you know. It's like I had a couple weeks, probably like two, but I wanted to do it sooner because I read the book and I fell in love with it. I did not know the book series. I just thought, oh, fantasy. Oh my gosh. I love Greek myths. I love Clash of the Titans. It was one of my favorite, you know, movies growing up. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna dive into this thing. And I think they only asked for two demos. I think I wrote like four or at least three. And those three, I think those three songs are the only demos that have, those songs have never changed throughout all the versions. You know, we had a 1 hour, then we expanded, and then we went to tour, we went to Broadway. There's been like 28 different songs cut from the show, at least between all the versions. But those original songs were the ones that helped get me the job were the ones that have kind of retained.
And what were those original songs? Do you remember?
Strong, the mother son song, I think the Oracle, that song with the spooky Oracle, and Killer Quest. I started a version of that song. Yeah.
So when you're pitching your idea and your product, you and Joe together, to the author.
Sure.
What does that look like?
Well, the first time, you know, I had to win Joe Trace over. I had to win TheaterWorks over. Joe Trace had dinner with Rick and his son, I believe. We knew, you know, we had to like make sure that we were good stewards of this property. So as soon as Joe and I knew we kind of had got the gig, we started doing workshops and R&D, and we brought Nancy and Marietta, who were Rick's agents, came in and were like, you can't do this. Can't cut these characters. We tried to combine a character, couldn't do that. You know, we had six actors at the time. And, you know, it's a lot of world building. It's a lot of characters. And so,
especially on these theater work tours, they're trying to take as little actors as possible.
So, sure, they got to take the set in a van and they can't travel around the country with it. So, you know, six actors playing like nearly 30 characters. You know, it ended up actually being such limitations that have been so freeing in all the best ways of how to tell the story. Just budgetarily, economically, also like artistically, of just being like, we have to create monsters in zero to make a monster. And how do we do that in a way that feels fun, slightly subversive, and in a way that uses our imagination, and that these actors can be a part of, where it engages the audience, where we fill in the blanks with it almost feels like Shakespearean in a way. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Where it's like participatory. And that kind of theater, that kind of scrappiness of it fits so perfectly with the tone and the themes of the show. You know, these are kids from, you know, not a lot of resources, from broken homes, that are finding all this detritus in the world that they've been left because their parents are these absentee Greek gods, and they take what they can to fight monsters. And it's the same thing. It's like, here are these actors with not many resources, telling this story in this kind of punk aesthetic, you know, to create this stuff. So that was very helpful to how to tell the story. And every time we'd invite fans to watch the workshops, we get feedback, and then we go to the drawing board and work, and then do it again. We did so much development. And
I was going to ask, because I know you said that the fans weren't a fan of the movie,
right?
And they had some beef with it, I guess. That's great that you were able.
Well, they felt hurt. They felt like the book that they loved wasn't kind of lovingly adapted properly in a way. And I, you know, that has nothing to, you know, there's a lot of moving parts that go into a movie, and I have nothing to say against the artists that go to make those things. Usually, on an incredibly fast time frame and budget and all that stuff. But the things that I think bristled with the fans were the kind of Hollywoodization of maybe the slickness of it, the special effects and the CGI of it were glossing over some of the more core fundamental things of story, of a, you know, on a mother and a son, of the kind of angst and loneliness of being a teenager. They aged up the characters a bit too, so there was a little bit of playing up the sexiness of it. And we were like, that is not what this, at least what the first book really is about. It's about friendship. It's about broken kids coming together and finding a sense of belonging. And I was like so thrilled that we don't have any character, especially any female character, defined by any relationship. They are their own people. And they're like, they got bigger worries than, you know, to save the world right now. You know what I mean? So I love that. I love that our show is like, let's get back to the books. Let's try to really, over and over again, we would be like, how do we solve this question about character, whatever? We'd go back to the books.
Did TheaterWorks always have the intentions to bring it off-Broadway?
We had no idea we would get the rights to be able to do it off-Broadway. We only thought we'd be able to do a little tour. And then Nancy Marietta, God bless them, they were like, we love this. We're going to fight to get the rights away from Fox Studios because the second movie just came out and kind of tanked. And so we were able to get the rights. And we did it. We did it off-Broadway as part of Free Summer Theater. And that was successful enough that we decided, and the weirdest thing happened. That's when we knew we had something kind of really special. It went on a couple tours, but that little one-hour version got nominated for Outstanding Musical for a Lortel against Hamilton at the time, which was off Broadway, and Fortress of Solitude, these incredible Michael Friedman musicals. And we knew, oh, wow, if our TYA show can be, you know, respected and loved like that, wow, maybe there's a bigger life for it. And that's when more and more conversations started of like, okay, after these tours go out, what could we do bigger than this? And we had always kind of secretly hoped, if only we could have had blah, 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 because we had to do so much compression of time to get that 1 hour to happen. So when they were like, let's do a two act, we're like, yay.
So what did that look like having to now, I'm sure, did you bring back any songs that you cut?
Oh, it was hard. Well, you know, we had a fantastic director, Stephen Brackett. What a team too for that 1 hour. Sam Pinkleton too, who worked on Natasha Pierre, brilliant, you know, mind. And then we brought on equally brilliant choreographer, Patrick McCollum, who worked on Band's Visit. But we like Stephen likes to talk about, oh, we were going to add more and more action, more and more adventure, more story. And then we suddenly realized actually what we need is time to breathe with these characters. We need the stakes to be raised. We need to actually feel more of the backstory of these characters and emotional weight. And we were writing the two act right during the election, and that kind of put an interesting spin on our kind of where what we were at, especially a song like Bring On the Monsters. And here is this song at the end of this show that says, your parents and your leaders may not have your best interests at heart. You have to not fight your parents' battles. You have to decide what's right for yourself. And I'm like, wow, to have that in a, you know, a family-friendly show, that kind of message to say like, things are not going to be easy for you and you're going to have to figure things out on your own and you're going to have to take initiative to make the change you want to see in the world. We all were like, this show means more to us than just a fun fantasy series, as it always was more to the fans. YA, it's such a great vehicle for kind of this universality of dealing with our kind of state of arrested development that we all have as people, issues with our parents, issues of feeling not worthy, issues of belonging. Those are all things that are so heightened when we're kind of middle grade and all those books. And they're such a perfect, perfect metaphor to getting us into those things we can talk about in ways like fantasy and genre, which you also don't see in theater very often. So that's one of the other things I'm so proud of, that this was like a fantasy, you know, you never see that really. I mean, we have Hadestown now, but like it's rare to see other Greek myths, or other fantasy adapted on stage.
And you guys are right across the street, especially from each other.
Comedy. Yeah, it's really fun like that. So yeah, that was kind of in our back of our minds, kind of as we were making the show, of how we adapted this and created this two act version. And then things snowballed from there with the cast recording. And Drama Desk nominations, which kind of blew us out of the water too. We you know, that.
Yeah, I'm sure the visibility of that cast recording.
It helped significantly. Helped, yeah. I mean, it was a two-month run. We were so proud of it. TheaterWorks kind of produced it on their own and with some help. And we thought, oh, we're done. Wow, what a great run. And then this cast recording, it was the most pre-sales Broadway Records had ever had. And we're like, wow. Which perked up some other producers' ears. And they were like, huh, what could we do? And when the idea of a tour came along, you know, about a year and a half later, that was like, well, it was actually not that far afterwards. It just takes about a year and a half to launch a tour. But what a great idea, too, to say that message that we had kind of found with our show. How cool would it be to take that message to some of the largest theaters all across the country, you know, and get kids who may never have seen a theater piece before to see their favorite characters and to see this story? That was such an exciting opportunity that we just couldn't say no.
I was going to ask a question about, so basically the show went on tour twice.
Yeah.
So I want to know like what the differences were, if there were any, I mean, aside from the length of it and the probably overall production.
Oh, well,
value,
I mean, like the cornerstones of the kind of the characters of the big songs like Good Kid didn't exist in the 1 hour version or Migraine Plan, which is Annabeth's kind of main song in act two. It's my favorite song in the show, actually.
Yeah, those two are two of my favorites.
They're kind of the songs you think about when you these characters. Those were created for the two act. There was just a lot of compression of time we had to have done in the one act version that we were able to then expand. Actually, I think it was Barbara Pasternak's idea that was like, I want a big underworld sequence. And I was like, oh God, Spooky Mormon Hell Dream kind of knocked it out of the park. How could I possibly compete with that? And then we started playing around with ideas, and I was like, well, Hell is a record company. Well, the Underworld, I should say, is a record company. And I'm like, wow, we have this other actor. Well, this is what we got for the two act version. We got seven actors, and now they're playing like 47 characters. I was like, I have this amazing actor. At the time, it's Carrie Compare, and I'm like, I got to give her like a showstopper. And that's when we were like, oh, if it's a different record company, if it's a record company, we can play around with different genres. But if we had this kind of disco soul, kind of Donna Summers thing unifying it all, that could be kind of this really cool, scary, fun sequence. And that's how that kind of was born as a way in. But again, it came from the book, right? It was a fun thing from the book. But this kind of finding its own theatrical way, because we had this incredible actor in the book, it's played by a man. But I was like, everybody plays everybody in this show. And it felt right within the spirit of this thing to give this like killer moment for this actor. And so moments like that came out of kind of inspiration.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned that you built something based off of one of the actors, because that seems to be the case a lot of the time.
Sure.
So I'm interested to know, you guys have had such a different cast each time. Mm-hmm. Is Chris the only one that's done all of it?
Chris
McCarroll
has done every version since 2013, the very first workshop ever.
Wow.
Sarah Beth Pfeiffer did that very first mini tour as well, the Minotaur.
are full of great fun tonight.
Right? And that was before we even had a band or anything. That was just like a piano running around. And so it's incredible to have both of them back. Chris McCarroll joined the 2017 cast, as did Sarah Beth Pfeiffer and Kristen Stokes and James Hayden Rodriguez. So all four of them, so half the cast from that off-Broadway has done the tour and Broadway.
So how have you worked with those challenges of, I mean, I'm sure you're auditioning people with the same vocal ranges and stuff like
sort
that.
Sort of. I mean, it's a really demanding show. It's a rock show. Again, there's seven actors. They never, almost ever leave the stage. They're playing all these characters. They're singing off stage while they're changing. There's no sweeteners. There's all kinds of backing vocals and sound effects and screams and stage combat. And it's a rock show. It's high energy. We lucked out because my wife is the vocal coach on the show. She was the vocal coach on Be More Chill. And this was like totally not nepotism. I had no idea that she was going to be hired for the show. This is the first time we've ever worked together too. And she's great at like helping manage voices as well, because it's a tough thing. But yeah, every time you work with a new actor, I mean, when we were in rehearsals off Broadway, George Salazar was so flippin' funny, and we decided, well, why don't we just give the Mr. D character to him? And then he was so funny. I was like, I went ahead and literally, I think it was one afternoon, took a scene that Joe had written and turned it into another terrible day for George. So it was really fun to then, when you get another actor like Jarrell, okay, how do we reinvent that song for Jarrell, right? In terms of key, in terms of tone, in terms of all kinds of orchestration. What does each actor bring that I can play with? You know, with Jaylin, you know, stylistically, are there moments where it feels like a riff is going to help with the storytelling? I never want to just riff to riff, but if there is like a reason behind it that could feel cool and meaningful, what can we find there? And like Kristen Stokes, who's been out with us so long, it's like, okay, how do we find another nuance to you? What can we do in every version of this that we haven't tried with this song yet? Like Killer Quest, which has been around for a billion years. I was having her try different riffs and different takes on lines and things all the way up until previews on Broadway. So that's, you know, shows never end. You just have to stop working on them.
But no, I'm interested to know, you just talked about, you know, your balance of book and music and all that throughout the show. So I'm wondering how you guys, you and Joe, do you guys map it out in the beginning of, you know, well, you need to hit this point, this point, this point?
Sure. I mean, it was a true collaboration. It's one of the greatest joys of my life is to be able to like really collaborate with everyone. There was no like, well, this idea is coming from the artistic director, so, you know, that's less valid, or the art, or sometimes from the choreographer. It's like a lot of times it would be like, this is the problem, we have to solve it. You know, with a show as plot heavy as ours, Joe had kind of elegantly structured a lot of things that then I could cannibalize if it was a scene and maybe turn into a song. Like one night, but it was hard because he was bi-coastal at the time. He was writing Lemony Snicket for a series of unfortunate events for Netflix in California and Vancouver. He was shooting. So it was very kind of like we'd have these bursts of like, cram as much as we could. I mean, we wrote the campfire song. He was staying over at my apartment and we like wrote it. We stayed up all night writing it. It was like so much fun. But there were other moments where, you know, I knew he would be gone and he was like, Rob, I know you want to write a song here for Percy. And I'm like, I do. And I know what it should be. And I went ahead and wrote Good Kid on my own. Just kind of knowing what the moment should be without a scene, without anything. I don't like to always do that because then sometimes songs can feel general and I really, really work from as many parameters as possible. Give me a time frame, give me the what we have to achieve in this one moment and how do I do that? And the gears just turn. I remember Son of Poseidon was a really tricky thing. And they were like, you got to solve this, Rob. It's a, we were at dinner. It was like everybody was at dinner and they were all like, okay, we have to get from the underworld to a beach and a fight and then back to camp and you got to do it. You got to fix it. Like it should be one song and like unify all that action and plot. And I don't know what Joe, give me something, give me a title, give me a hook because
did you work from music or lyrics?
I work for that, an idea. I work from like a thesis statement. That's, you know, I was an English major and a musical theater major at Michigan. So I kind of the conceit of an idea first, what is the crux of what we're getting at. And then everything has to support that. So if it's this big sequence, what is the unifying idea? And I need a title. And Joe said, Son of Poseidon. And I was like, okay, yes. In the underworld, it's the gift that his dad gives him, his dad that he had always kind of, you know, resented, finally kind of showing up for him. And him taking that gift gets him out of the underworld. And then taking ownership of who he is, forgiving his dad and saying, okay, I am going to help him. I'm going to use the power that I have bequeathed by me from my dad and use it to defeat this guy. And then at the end of that whole sequence, he meets his dad and they get to have this kind of heart to heart moment. And so that whole sequence was strung together by that idea of railing against your father, accepting your father, you know, all of those things with this one hook, the Son of Poseidon. And all these other songs and montages that I had written could fit within that. There's a reprise of like two different songs that happen within that whole sequence. I'm always in awe of somebody like Michael John Lacusa, who's able to write like a song that's in a song. It's like a song within a song within a song. These like box songs, like Russian Dolls, or you like a, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I wanted to do with a song like that. But yeah, it was like a whole team effort. That was fight choreographer, choreographer, artistic director, book writer, director, and me all coming together to say, okay, how do we make this entire sequence work? And that was like really exciting. It's that puzzle. Your brain just is like, and I had like 2 days to do it, and we had like like a producer reading that in like 2 days. So I don't like to be able to tout myself as being a fast writer, because I feel like that feels like, oh, he didn't put any effort into it. The truth of the matter is, when you've been working on a show for several years, you know where all the pieces are. They're all out there. You just have to kind of like grab the ones that you need and then try to fit it. Oh, that didn't work. Okay, fit the next one until it finally comes together. But you've been thinking about it for so long that when it finally starts firing, you're like, and then you see it all working together. And when you see it now on a Broadway stage with all the other stuff that we have, how he defeats, you know, Ares with this incredible water, that's so thrilling. It's so thrilling how it all came together in that moment.
So I was going to ask, because I feel like this question probably gets asked a lot as a writer specifically, composer, even more specifically, of the music or lyrics first.
Yeah, like the hook.
And that's what I was saying. It sounds like it really just depends on the situation.
It's a scene that's really funny, that's a wordy idea song, that it might be the lyric first, especially like Another Terrible Day. But, you know, when I get up and I'm bummed out about whatever, my wife always laughs. I'm always, everything's the worst. So I just wanted a song that had the like, the worst, and it like that. And we stumbled across like Lewis Black was kind of, that comedian was our inspiration for that character. So I kind of like listened to his rhythm pattern of how he spoke and did comedy, and then we kind of based the scenes and song kind of on that rhythm. It was kind of jazzy. He's a little older, he's a little grumpier, so then that would be determined the key. And I was like, oh, it's kind of minory. Okay, so that helped create that sound. I'm trying to write from character. I want to write in their vernacular, so I got to think about what is the accompaniment that's going to fit that character, what is the kind of melodic phrasing of that character. Like Percy is like explosive, so he's got this very rangy kind of up and down thing. Grover is kind of this sweet nature guy, so he's kind of stays kind of up here, you know, those kinds of things.
So that definitely leads me to what I was thinking earlier. I was wondering what the relationship is between you and the orchestrator.
Yeah.
And how much of the orchestrations might come from you. I know you said that, you know, certain characters are certain instruments. Well, so what is that conversation like?
I've worked as an orchestrator and as an arranger before. You know, I'm excited. I'm working on arranging and orchestrating a co-arranging with Joey Conis, this punk rock girl. It's this all female fronted punk songs. It's a jukebox musical. And that's been really fun. To like play around with the style and stuff like that on kind of iconic punk songs. For this, I brought in a really great orchestrator named Wiley DeWeese. Wiley worked on as a music director on like shows like Amelie, and he worked on the Michael Friedman project, getting all those great songs that we might not otherwise get to hear. And Wiley and I collaborated a lot on how do we first off Broadway and then on the tour and now on Broadway, how do we expand it? What can we do to make this, the big moments, feel grandiose with the confines of a rock band, right? I always wanted it to feel like a gut punch of rock music. So it's very guitar led. And so Wiley actually suggested Kevin Wunderlich, who's an incredible guitar with a name like Wunderlich, you better be. he worked for Sky Pony, you know, Kyle Jarrow's band, who I adore, you know, what a great book writer and songwriter. He wrote the book to SpongeBob and Lauren Worsham's wife. And so Kevin was such an incredible guitarist playing all this kind of pop stuff. And I was like, could he really shred? And then I found out he was in a death metal band called Couch Slut. And they're heavy. They play like St. Vitus and all these like heavy. And so I was like, well, he's the guy to lead this band. And so he has a million pedals, and we create like, okay, how do I create like textured effects of like the gods and like atmosphere that feels cinematic? Well, I go to my classical roots. I used like inspiration from like Gustav Holst's The Planets and things like that. I'd use a lot of like percussive sounds and textures, a lot of like main stage stuff, but we don't get too crazy on sound effects. It's a lot of like creating organic sounding magic.
Well, and that kind of goes along with some of the other elements of the show, props and stuff like that. Like you have lawn, leaf blowers, and
toilet paper,
like
and all that stuff. Well, it's again that same like DIY aesthetic, right?
Yes.
Rick, I'm gonna screw up his last name. Quentin. He's the artistic director at Chicago Shakes, who got to see our theater. Lovely man. Oh my God, that theater is beautiful. But he came out to see our opening in Chicago. And he said to me, your show has rough magic. And I thought, that's the terminology for what we're trying to achieve. And from a Shakespeare artistic director, that definitely was like, oh, he gets it. He gets what we're going for. And that is the spirit of that came in through in the orchestrations as well of, yeah, how can we make this scrappy and fun, but still like use maybe an ebow to create that sound of with the water, you know, but still a guy playing it on a guitar. And then we use things like melodicas and silly instruments that actually bulk out some of the vocal padding and things like that. And I use the ensemble as like textures, like synth pads and things like that, because it's oohs and ahs, which can create atmosphere. So again, it's all stuff that people are doing for real. You know, that's part of what Stephen Brackett and Joe Trace talk about is like, when you see our show, it's like you have been at camp. You can touch it, you can feel it, you are welcome there, you know, and you feel like you've been there, you know.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you, what's the experience like when you're watching the show that you've spent so many years and so many iterations of right on stage?
Eight times a week.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the audiences have been incredible, and to you get these feedback from people that they've said this is their first show, or this show has like helped them through things, or these books save their lives. And sometimes, you know, Jarrell was a huge fan of the books growing up. And so now he gets to be one of his favorite characters, which is unreal. So he was a fan. So like, that's amazing. But, you know, we were in Florida. We got the students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas got to go on stage with us. And that was really powerful. We got to let them do a concert version of the show. To see kind of all these people from all different ages, a lot of young people though, in particular, finding a love for theater, finding a love for books through our show too. They'll be like, oh, I'm going to read a book now because I saw a theater piece, or vice versa. How cool is that?
So cool.
We're unlocking imaginations, and like, and it gets to a larger question that I'm not going to go too into, but I'll get for a second on my soapbox here and just say that like, there is a space for YA stories and for different genres and demographics. There are a lot of barriers to break to get those stories on a larger platform and to be accepted on those larger platforms, and how we critique those stories, how we evaluate and accept them is part of a larger conversation to be had, and kind of a sea change that we're seeing with what Broadway is, right? Because Broadway is commercial theater, and there is a lot of kind of uglier sides of classism and things that are a part of that. And part of what I'm really proud of our show is that, you know, our producers are keeping the price point for the you know, some of the seats at $39. Everybody should have access to see theater, everyone. And those stories should be reflective that we are trying to get on stage of everyone, of larger demographics of, and that demographics can be young people, right? And if we're trying to inspire an entire generation of new theater goers, shouldn't we want them to share in this art form and find accessibility in that art form and not talk down to them in their art form? So, I mean, it's an interesting thing that you see in other media, like movies and, you know, superhero films and other YA stuff we're seeing in television and stuff like that. But in theater, genre is a really tricky thing. Genre is like sci-fi, fantasy, things like that, and the kind of humor that a show like ours will have, or Be More Chill will have.
It's a tricky
thing to find kind of the traditional model, right? Or a gaze, if we will, right? We're trying to create other opportunities.
Well, yeah, because I don't know the statistics, but I'm sure that the general age, the mean age of a theater goer is on Broadway is later.
Yeah, it's
later in life, not the early.
And it's ages. Not it's not cheap. It's right. not cheap.
And families, you know,
trying to get
four people trying to go. A lot of people have this misconception that everything is at least $100.
Sure.
You just said there's $39 tickets to this. Right. And there are for a lot of
And there's also shows. A perception, too, that if I'm going to pay that much money, I need to see that money on the stage for it to be of value. That's also part of a kind of a something that I hope that gets demystified a bit in terms of what Broadway is. You know what I mean? Because there is room. There is room for all kinds of things. And just if one show is big and flashy and one show is scrappy and you know, kind of minimalistic, that doesn't make them any less than, you know, or that one is taking away from another. I think that's so exciting that our show is part of a trend like that. I mean, look at this season. What a cool season. A show like Slave Play can be on Broadway. How cool is that?
Such a good play.
Crazy. And maybe the answer too is to have limited runs, you know, as well. You know, that might be part of what a new thing is. Sorry, I got on a big old soapbox.
No,
here.
We like going there.
This is a very hot topic, I would say.
No, I think it is. Across the whole industry. You know, we're battling kind of old trends, and you see it kind of not just in the arts, you see it kind of universally. You see it in our country, you see it in the world of, you know, everything from, it's generational too. It's baby boomers. It's, you know, it's patriarchal things as well, but it's classism as well. It's all kinds of those things and how we quantify things. You know, I've been so proud of our show. I'm just as proud of our show when it was 1 hour in a cafetorium and the kids and the lives that we changed in those audiences as we are for whoever gets to see it on Broadway or who got to see it on our regional theater. I'm as equally proud of that. It doesn't make it, when people are like, oh, you made it on Broadway. I'm glad to be a part of a larger conversation. And hopefully that will get other producers to produce more things that take chances and risks like our show. But that also, I feel like as a storyteller, negates a lot of the work that we do, which is a lot of times done for many years in rehearsal rooms and off-Broadway theaters and regional theaters and things like that. That doesn't make it any of less value.
Do you think that you have a mission statement as an artist?
I think a little bit. I mean, I like to write about things that scare me and you know, the state of the world we're at right now. And I think a lot about my own privilege. I think a lot about toxic masculinity. I think I'm writing a musical about a cult and patriarchy and like groupthink. It's funny and it's silly and scary. And there's monsters, of course, because I love to write about monsters.
I'm fascinated by groupthink right now.
Yeah,
it's come up like so much, I think, in the last 2 months in my life alone of just conversations. So I'm so interested in this.
Well,
it's called groupthink. Experience Marianas. It's a musical that you get indoctrinated into a cult in real time. We did a workshop of it at Cap 21. I'm working on an album out of it right now. I'm working on it with Sarah Beth Pfeiffer, one of the actors. And we work with Sherry Eden Barber, who's an amazing director and kind of a staunch feminist. And somebody I was like, I want to learn from you and I want to write about this thing. And using kind of like the Chromatics and Twin Peaks and kind of fun new wave music as a vehicle to like explore kind of how we get sucked in wanting so much belonging that we start to lose identity because we go along with something. And then how do we wake up from that? Because we're inundated with information, and how do we make our way when sometimes we just want someone to tell us the answer, you know? So I'm excited about projects like that. So maybe that's my mission statement. I mean, I was an actor for many, many years and always tried to find projects that I thought would be
aligned with your own.
Aligned with my own. And that's hard. It doesn't always happen.
Doesn't always pay the bills to do that too.
or, you know, and this is why my kind of story of the last couple of years has come full circle, because I booked a Broadway show as an actor. And then unfortunately, the weekend before our rehearsal started, that's what I learned accordion for 6 months. The producers pulled out and we never got to do it. And so that was right around the same time that I found Lightning Thief kind of fell in my lap. And I thought, okay, if I've lost agency as an actor to take, you know, to tell stories I want to tell, all right, I'll make my own, or I'll find things that I can adapt or things that I can do that I do have some kind of control over.
It's so powerful of like, you know, as an actor, a lot of times, I mean, you just said it, just you don't have, you're not in the driver's seat a lot of times. Those choices aren't yours.
Well, fortunately, the technology is helping us a bit with that. You know, it's hurtful and helpful, right? It's helpful, though, in the advent of like YouTube and social media, that you can be your own brand ambassador and take back some of your own, you know, power and narrative of what you see as your strengths, and that you can show that off for casting directors and create podcasts and create, you know, YouTubes and, you know, videos and, you know.
But you're able to create the thing on your own. You don't have to rely on the producer who's going to come in and cast you. You know, those are things it puts you in the driver's seat.
Look at Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Look at, you know, some of these projects where, they were, okay, I'm going to do this on my own. If no one's going to see my worth, I'll make it on my own. I mean, that's what Monster Songs, my graphic novel, came out of. I was just like, okay, no one understands what I'm going for. I'm trying to make a graphic novel rock album. Cool. But it's also a theater piece.
Can you explain that?
Well, yeah, people just, I have a copy of it. I'll just show it to you. But it's graphic novel. It's 120 pages, beautiful graphic novel told from different monsters' points of view, kind of examining toxic masculinity, how we other people. But it seems a little trite of like, oh, it's just monsters and monster archetypes. But I think it's really quite moving. You know, the troll under the bridge is based on the homeless guy that lives down the street from me. Medusa is, you know, someone who we vilify, but she has had a really dark story and to like get her to hear from her side. And so these, all these kind of broken creatures that I try to humanize again, to put their stories back in context, and with a different art for each monster, with beautiful illustrations by David O'Neill, who's such a chameleon. And the idea was that each song would be in a different style. So one song might be kind of, you know, Adele inspired, or one might be a 60s girl group inspired flavor song, or one might be kind of more heavy rock. And so that was kind of the impetus for the project, to kind of play with style and genre, but with horror, which is a lot of fun. We're even working on it with VR right now to try to make a VR game, which is pretty cool.
To go with it?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
We're looking at it as like, how do we push the envelope of how we embrace technology and storytelling? Can we do it as kind of an immersive storytelling event, kind of like a Sleep No More, but do it as a musical? And it's tricky. It's tricky to get win over hearts and minds, especially in regional theaters, to be like, how do we do that? But immersive can mean different things. It can be environmental as well. But I love the synergy you get from, I hate that word, but it's the word to use, of the visual element of artwork mixed with an actor's live blood and sweat and tears and a rock band. There's just something so wonderful about that connection of all that together.
Do you consider yourself a multi-hyphenate artist? I'm always so curious.
I'm a storyteller. That's what I think of myself as. I mean, if I'm a music director, how am I going to help tell the story is the best as a music director and make sure the cast is and the band are on board with what we're trying to achieve? If I'm a orchestrator, how can I, you know, do what the writer has done and like, how do I elevate that to get the most out of it? Or if I'm a actor, what do they need me to do? How am I a part of this thing?
I'm assuming, but do you think that one helps the other or one infers the other?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I have such a love for actors and such an admiration for them. Oh my God, I saw Tina last night. Adrienne Warren is unreal.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm dying.
She like had sung a song for me back when she was in college in like Marymount, Manhattan. I just was like blown away by her. And then, you know, kind of have followed her career over the last couple of years, but good God.
She has an alternate, right?
She does. Okay, I don't know how she's doing it. It's nearly 2.5 hour show. I don't know. It's unreal. But I love actors so much. And I think like when I'm writing a song for them, I try to think about, well, all right, in terms of range and hook and emotion and things like that, I definitely put myself in their shoes. I'm like, if I don't buy it, then they're not going to buy it. I've done plenty of workshops and readings of quote unquote new musicals where I feel like the actors have to try to polish something really hard and make sense of stuff. So I try really, really hard to be as specific as I can so that and answer the questions of what the subtext and what's going on so that they feel like they've got a framework to do their job as best they can. So they don't have to just work from nothing and make things up. I'm so excited about that collaborative process too, about like, okay, what are you not getting? What are you getting? That's what you're seeing in this. Okay, cool. Let's take it in that direction or whatever.
And I'm sure because you have the experience of work wearing these different hats, if you will, it really helps you think kind of in their shoes to make it, you know, that much more collaborative.
Yeah. It's fun. I wish I was able to do more. I wish in terms of like, I wish I was able to be a choreographer. I'd be like, oh, that's why we're doing this in XYZ, you know.
Have you ever danced before?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I danced for, I love tap. I'm just not very good at it. I wish I was. I can do a triple time step. I went to school for theater.
Well, yeah. I don't dance, though. So we always ask our guests this question of what's the last great piece of theater that you saw?
Oh, man. There's so much great theater. I'm like on my list. I'm seeing Soft Power next week. I'm seeing Slave Play the week after. I'm like, there's a lot of shows.
Okay, those two shows.
There's a lot of shows.
Barry has been talking about those.
There's a lot of shows that I'm really excited to see. Shows that have like really got me. I mean, I really did love Hadestown. I thought it's a beautiful story. And as an artist, that idea of like, we may fail, but we're going to tell that story anyway, right? Here's to us doing that. You know, it's the very thing my wife like didn't like that message. She's like, why
really? Did
they just? And I was like, well, that's the whole beautiful message that I love so much. But it's like, but that's the conversation that the thing has too. I did like that. But shows like The Pillow Man was like one of my most thrilling nights of theater I've ever seen. I didn't know how in God's name, at the end of act one, you were going to have an act two. And I'm like, I love seeing shows that seem like impossible to have on a stage. And they're like, how are they going to do that? Michael R. Jackson, you know, is an incredible writer. I love Strange Loop. I thought that was one of the last amazing things I've seen. I'm excited to see Love and Hate Nation out in Two River with Joey Conis. I've seen that in a couple different iterations. So yeah, really excited to see that.
Much good theater.
I love those artists in particular, not just because I know them and love them as friends, but because they're so honest. They're brutally honest and care so much about trying to make something authentic of their worldview. And there's nothing better than an artist when you like see something, you're like, ah, I know exactly what that is your point of view. And I can see it so clearly. I love that. And that's what creates universality too. It's so specific to them. And yet, wow, you know?
Yeah. Is there anyone out there in the world that you haven't worked with that you're really hoping to like put it out there in the universe?
Well, oh man.
Or what's so the next Rachel book Tarkin.
I mean, there's
adaptation
a
adaptation you want to do.
Well, kind of my mission last year was I wanted to try to work with artists that don't have my worldview, and, or don't look like me. So, you know, I'm excited about working again with Sherry Eden Barber, who's a great director. It's a lot of incredible female directors that I'm just like in awe of, that I'm just like, would jump it in a second to work with. You know, oh yeah, speaking of, I'm so excited, Diana Apollos, I'm so excited to see Jack Little Pill. Can't wait to see that. So yeah, there's just collaborators come kind of, you never know until you find like the story that you're like, oh, that, ooh. I was just approached maybe for a story from my friend Preston Allen, who I love, and we've worked on some stuff together. He's really awesome. I don't know if you saw We Are Tigers. It's a really fun, kitschy musical around Broadway.
No, I haven't. No, you're talking about. I saw.
So he and I might work on something. I don't know.
Be on the lookout, cool. Everyone.
Yeah, there is a lot of really cool work, and so I'm excited to just kind of throw my hat in the ring and be like, okay, not the usual suspects. Who can I find?
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Gosh, we appreciate it so much.
Yeah,
well,
guys. Where can our listeners find you?
Okay,
in the ethernet.
So on the old interwebs, I'm R O K I C K S on the tweets and the Instagrams.
It's like a cheer.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna say it again, but
there's a kick in the middle. That's it.
We'll link it in our description notes as well. Yeah. Just to make it a little bit easier.
Go catch Lightning Thief before it closes on January.
January 5th. So we're
2020.
Yeah, we're at the Long Acre Theater. It's a beautiful theater. Love it.
We were sitting in there and I was like, I don't think I've ever been in this theater, but I always love looking at like the little designs and like how intricate they are.
You see the prom?
I saw that.
I love the prom.
I did not see the prom.
It's a beautiful theater. The sound is great there too.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. I listen for that now. My boyfriend is a sound engineer, so I must.
Oh, it's a hard thing. It's a good job.
Also, not having a podcast now, it's like all I think about.
Think about sound a lot.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks, you guys.
Bye.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Page to Stage. To keep up with us, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Page to Stage Podcast.
And if you're enjoying these conversations, we would really appreciate it if you could take a couple minutes to rate and review us wherever you're listening to this podcast. Until next time.
That's Brian.
That's Mary.
We'll see you later.
Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.